From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Salman Rushdie. It's been over 3 years since the Ayatollah Khomeini issued the death sentence that sent Rushdie into hiding, but it hasn't silenced him. We'll talk with him by phone about his life in hiding and his latest writing. Also, just in time for tonight's season finale of Northern Exposure, we talk with John Cullum. He plays Holling Vincour, a 63-year-old tavern owner in love with an 18-year-old beauty queen. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel Clockers by Richard Price. It's his first book in several years. Price has been busy writing screenplays like The Color of Money and Sea of Love. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Thailand, anti-government protests continued today, as did arrest of hundreds of people. Troops fired on demonstrators outside the Royal Hotel as the government's Department of Public Relations and the tax office burned. There are conflicting reports about the number of people killed and wounded. Demonstrators have been demanding the ouster of the prime minister, a former army chief who led a coup attempt last year. In Washington, State Department officials have said that they might cancel joint military exercises with Thai forces. Former Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger was notified this spring that he was the target of the grand jury investigating the Iran-Contra affair. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
When Weinberger got what is called a target letter, it meant simply that prosecutors were considering an indictment. Although the grand jury ran out of time last week and was forced to dissolve, Iran-Contra Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh can easily convene another grand jury and ask for an indictment then. That is a course of action that Walsh is now weighing. In the meantime, Walsh has begun meeting with Weinberger's lawyer, Robert Bennett. Bennett will not comment about the matter except to say that the former defense secretary has done nothing wrong. But the prosecutor and the defense lawyer are holding ongoing discussions, with friends of the prosecutor saying he wants some sort of guilty plea from Weinberger, and friends of Weinberger saying Walsh is trying to pressure the former defense secretary into implicating President Reagan or other higher-ups in an Iran-Contra cover-up. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
A Food and Drug Advisory panel has ruled that the sleeping pill Halcyon is safe and effective. At the same time, it recommended changes in its labeling because of concerns over possible psychiatric side effects. The agency had been asked to take the drug off the market, based in part on the ruling by the British government to ban its sale there. In Germany, a major industrial strike has been averted after last-minute talks between employers and union leaders. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
After weeks of unsuccessful bargaining, negotiators for several regions of Germany's metalworkers union announced they would accept an 18-month wage package. Salaries will rise nearly 5.5% this year and an additional 3% next year. Employers also promised to introduce a 36-hour work week in the next 2 years. The compromise agreement headed off a potentially crippling strike for German industry, which would have proved especially damaging for the country's important car industry. After the surprise agreement, a settlement of a wage dispute in the printing industry seemed more likely. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 23 points to close at 3,376.03. On volume of some 145 million shares, trading was moderate. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, a new ceasefire has been signed by the various warring factions. Even though this latest agreement is to end fighting for the next 3 weeks, truce violations have been reported. This agreement calls for a pullout of the Serbian-controlled Federal Army from barracks in the capital. However, Serbian military troops from the area have been asked to stay, to become part of a new armed force. In the past 45 days, some 1,500 people have been killed and 7,000 wounded in the fighting. Virginia Governor Wilder has refused to intervene in the scheduled execution Wednesday of a man convicted of raping and murdering his sister-in-law. The case has drawn worldwide attention. Kevin Hall reports from Richmond.
Attorneys for Roger Keith Coleman claim they have new evidence not allowed on appeal that proves their client did not rape and kill his sister-in-law in 1981. Governor Doug Wilder says he's reviewed Coleman's request for clemency including a 20-minute videotape from death row. But the governor is refusing to block Wednesday's scheduled execution.
I viewed all the facts, the evidence, the circumstances, and concluded that I would not intervene, and I have not found instances of substantial injustice, nor have I found evidence which would have amounted to what has been described as actual innocence.
Roger Coleman says the courts appear more concerned with technicalities than justice. Additional federal court appeals are expected. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Hall in Richmond.
There are reports that police in Haiti have started arresting people trying to flee. These arrests come after a record surge in Haitian refugees and an agreement by the Organization of American States to tighten sanctions on Haiti. According to U.S. officials, the number of Haitians at a U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, has now risen to over 11,000 from a low of 2,000 people in March. I'm Ann Taylor, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Salman Rushdie has spent 3 years and 3 months in hiding. The death sentence, or fatwa, issued against him by the Ayatollah Khomeini, remains in effect. The million-dollar bounty on his head has been doubled to $2 million. But in spite of all that, he sometimes manages to get out, and that's important both for his own sanity and to keep his case before the public eye. At the end of March, he came to the United States for a brief visit. He hopes America and other Western governments will pressure Iran to revoke the fatwa. And even though he's in hiding, he's still writing and getting published. The paperback edition of Satanic Verses was recently brought out by a consortium of publishers. And now Granta has published a paperback edition of Rushdie's essays from 1981 to 91. It's called Imaginary Homelands. We arranged for Rushdie to call us so we could talk about his recent writing and then find out how the efforts to end the fatwa were going.
Unfortunately, I mean, one would have hoped that the effect would have been greater by now of all these months of campaigning that's been going on both by me and on my behalf, because in the end, you see, one has to understand the real nature of this problem. The real nature of this problem isn't that there are thousands and thousands of people out there really anxious to do me harm. The problem is that there's a government out there which has been trying to finance and arrange an assassination, and the way it's going to end this problem is when that government can be persuaded to desist. So, I mean, that's the nature of the deadlock right now, which is that the Iranians are being told by the British and by European governments and so forth that they have to sort out this problem before relations can be normalized, and they're not doing so. So that's the, you know, at the moment we seem to be in a state of more or less standoff.
I know when you were in the United States, you hoped to meet with American officials. And Marlon Fitzwater, the White House spokesperson, said there's no reason for us to have any special interest in Rushdie. I mean, he's an author. He doesn't write about government policies. And State Department spokesperson Margaret Tutwiler said that no one was meeting with you because at this time they felt that such a thing could be misinterpreted. Were you very disappointed that no one in the government would meet with you?
Oh, sure. I mean, I certainly was disappointed. I mean, I should say that I had made no attempt to set up such a meeting. I mean, I had been told that there was an interest amongst the senators in having some sort of meeting, and indeed that meeting did take place and was very helpful. I mean, a lot of senior senators met with me and expressed support and said that they would continue to press the case, and that's, of course, very valuable. I mean, naturally, it would have been very valuable if members of the administration had been willing to meet with me, and clearly it was very disappointing that they didn't. And I mean, I think Mr. Fitzwater's remarks about my being an author on a book tour were, I would have said, misplaced, because, I mean, if that's what it's like being on a book tour, then I mean, it's not surprising that so many writers dislike doing them.
The ultimate put-down of the book tour.
Exactly.
Well, you've said that people have to start seeing your position as a political, not just a religious issue.
Yeah. Well, I think that's true, because I think, you know, one of the things people in the West have, I think, in the last few years been obliged, partly by this issue, to become more aware of what's going on in the Islamic world and in those countries where fundamentalism is on the increase. One of the things I think is necessary for people to start seeing is that the incident of the Satanic Verses, or the case of the Satanic Verses, is not an isolated case. I mean, it's not that I'm somebody who did something so uniquely horrible that it required a uniquely horrible response. If you start looking at what's been happening to writers throughout the Islamic world, throughout Arab countries and in Iran, you see a mounting attempt to censor and attack and persecute writers in all those countries. Writers being sentenced to enormous jail sentences, writers having to go into exile, writers being jailed, persecuted, tortured, and in many cases even killed. And the interesting thing is that in every single one of those cases, the accusation made against those writers is that they have acted in a way that is insulting to Islam, that they have blasphemed, and so forth. I think one of the problems with the cloak that religion gives to dictators and to totalitarian regimes is that it uses a language which seems to obscure the political facts. Now, what's happening to me, what's happening to other writers throughout the Muslim world, is, in my view, nothing different than what happened to writers, for example, in Stalinist Russia. But somehow, when one is a dissident from a secularist, let's say, kind of communist regime, that becomes easy for other people to understand. But somehow, when people are dissidents and the regime opposing them is a religious regime, that somehow people get confused about what's going on.
Mm-hmm. England resumed diplomatic relations with Iran last year. Do you wish that they hadn't resumed before?
Well, they resumed very low-level relations. I mean, they have the minimum relationship, to say they've exchanged charge d'affaires with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, they would say that the benefit that accrued from that was the release of the British hostages in Lebanon and the release of the British businessman, Roger Cooper, who was in jail in Tehran at the time. Now, I mean, I'd go along with that, even though, I mean, probably that's fair enough. But for a time, I was very alarmed by the possibility that they might not then go on to resume full relations with Iran before this issue was resolved. And I think, frankly, there was a point about 6 months ago when it looked likely that that might happen. Since then, it is true to say that the government, the British government, has strengthened its position and is now saying to Iran that it will not restore full relations, it will not exchange ambassadors and so forth, until this issue is resolved. So at least now that is clearly on the table.
Well, what effect did the release of the hostages have on you?
Well, for a start, it made it possible for me to speak freely for the first time throughout this period, because while there were Western hostages in Lebanon, I was constantly told, both by the government, I mean, both by the Foreign Office and by the media, that the louder I yelled, the more I was prolonging their problems. So I was in this sort of terrible cleft stick where, in order to pursue my own case, I would be accused of damaging the interests of other people whose condition was, if anything, even worse than mine. Now, that isn't so. I mean, now, for the first time, I'm able to say what I want to say and what I have to say, what I think needs to be said, without being accused of damaging other people's, safety or well-being. So it's unlocked my tongue, if you like, and it's also made it possible for me to contemplate other things which I'm pleased to say have happened, such as the publication of the paperback of the Static Verses, without being accused again of doing something which would prolong the hostage's agony.
Two of the translators of Satanic Verses were attacked, a Japanese and an Italian translator, and one was killed, one survived the attack. Was that a sign of an escalating attempt to find you, do you think?
Well, certainly that happened at a time last year when I was also hearing from intelligence sources of there being contracts out against my life. So I think there was a time last year when things became very dangerous, and the attacks on the translators showed exactly how dangerous. I mean, again, one has to hope that that period is gradually receding and that things will become safer. But, I mean, one can't do anything but go on repeating that this issue will not simply fade away and disappear. It will go away when it's fixed. And the way of fixing it is to have a serious political conversation between the Western government and the Iranian government. And, of course, if the United States government were to wish to lend its support to that, that would make a big difference. We're already in a situation where the British have a strong position, where many of the European governments has a First Amendment guaranteeing freedom of speech, would understand that this was an issue that affected them too.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Salman Rushdie, and he, I should mention, has a collection of essays that's just come out in paperback called Imaginary Homelands. And of course, as I'm sure you've heard, Satanic Verses is out in paperback as well. This is Fresh Air. Joining us on the telephone is Salman Rushdie. The last time we spoke was on, which was also the first time we spoke, making it sound like we've spoken so many times, but the other time we spoke was on December 21st of 1990. And you had said in that interview that you had not become more religious while you were in hiding and that you were still hoping that the paperback of Satanic Verses would soon be published. And then just a couple of days later, over the weekend, I'd read in the newspapers that you'd met with English Islamic leaders and that you had said you embraced Islam and that you had canceled the publishing of the paperback. What happened in that intervening time?
Well, for a start, let's be correct. I never canceled the paperback. I said that I would suspend it.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Yeah.
But it's... I've been through this a number of times, but I suppose what happened was I've characterized it many times as a mistake, and I think it was a fairly desperate attempt to break the deadlock. I was basically offered a kind of compromise by a number of Muslim leaders who said that they accepted the book was not insulting and so forth, and that in return for this they would make sure that there would be a big campaign inside the Muslim world explaining that. And I suppose it was a kind of desperate throw, trying to get some progress on this issue. But I shouldn't have done it because it put me in a false position. I mean, it put me in a position of saying, of making statements which I couldn't really adhere to. Because, in fact, I don't have, in any formal sense, a religious belief. What I suppose, the way in which I justified it to myself, was to say that there was a developing secular trend inside Islamic thought, and it would be nice to be a part of that. And by telling myself that, after all, this was a book that came quite deeply out of Muslim culture, and there was no reason why I shouldn't make a statement of affiliation to that. But those were all, in a way, justifications. And there you are. It was a mistake. I mean, I think it was a mistake made for good reasons and under immense pressure, but it was still something I shouldn't have done. The moment I was able to say this, or what I've just said, the moment I was able to start saying this again, I immediately felt much better and much more like myself. And there you are. That's what happened. I mean, what happened, of course, is that the people who made all these promises to me didn't keep them.
What promises did they make that they broke?
Well, they said they were going to start an enormous campaign throughout the Muslim world, explaining that the book was not an insult. There were promises of sort of backstage political help from this or that Islamic country, which never materialized. There were a lot of things, but what actually happened was that within a day or two of having that meeting and shaking hands and being terribly cheery and friendly, they were beginning to abuse me in public again. So I basically felt as if I'd been had, and I think probably I had.
So has that made you more skeptical of making any kinds of deals with anybody else?
Well, I think it made me more skeptical, period. I think, you know, in a strange way, you know, The Satanic Verses is a novel that's, in fact, for whatever people say about it, actually is quite open-minded and even sympathetic about religious belief. But since then, I think one could say that religion has had such a catastrophic effect on my life that I'm probably less sympathetic towards it than I was when I wrote the novel.
In your new collection of essays, you write that the first article that you wrote at age 21 was actually banned by national censors. What was this article about?
It was a strange story. It's the sort of thing that happens. I'd just left university. I was 21 years old. My parents were in Pakistan. I'd gone back to be with them. typically undergraduate, really, essay about wandering around the streets of Karachi and being rather conventionally appalled by the poverty. And, I recall there being dying horses with flies on their eyeballs in this essay. But I don't recall there being anything directly political in it at all. And I was extremely surprised when I was told by the magazine that the press council, that's to say the Board of Censors, had turned it down completely. Actually, at that time, I had an uncle on the press council, so I said I'd go, in a rather kind of undemocratic way, I told the magazine I'd go and see my uncle and sort it out. So I did, but he was completely intransigent. He never told me why or what it was that was so terrible about what I'd done. He just said, we feel it would be in your best interest for this not to be published.
Oh, even an uncle was saying that.
Even my uncle, yes. Very strange place, a country under total censorship is a very strange place.
Well, how did that shape your attitude about censorship?
Well, I tell you, when you're a young writer just starting out, there's a thing that's very difficult that censorship does to you, which is that actually you don't know if you're good or bad. I mean, for example, there's something rather glamorous about being censored. So that, for example, in the case of the story we've just been discussing, it would have been very easy for me to conclude that I'd written something explosive and brilliant and far too advanced for these people to tolerate. Whereas actually, it was a piece of juvenilia. It wasn't something that I would now look back on with any kind of pride. Now, it's very difficult in a situation where you can be glamorized by censorship on the one hand, and on the other hand, where you actually can't openly discuss your work, so you can't learn and progress. One of the reasons why I didn't stay in Pakistan, why I went back to live in England, was because I felt I had to be in a climate in which it was possible to know that when people liked your work, it was because it was good rather than because it was towing a party line. And when people disliked your work, it was because it was bad rather than because it was offending against some party line.
Right. I've been seeing some of your reviews, in magazines and book reviews, and I guess I always wonder, like, how do you manage to do it, to get an assignment in hiding?
Well, I mean, I'm able to receive mail. I mean, I'm not going to go into great detail about how that happens, but it's I've had a relationship with a newspaper in Britain for whom I've been writing reviews quite regularly, and I would be sent books and read them and send back the reviews. I mean, the mail still works even when you're living in this curious underground life.
Do you feel that your situation has made you any more critical or benevolent a reviewer?
Oh, I hope it hasn't. I hope it hasn't changed my attitude towards that at all. And I think if you're writing reviews, well, the hardest thing to do is to review books that are written by people you know. But even then, you do actually end up having to tell the truth. I mean, I think one of the most difficult things I had to do in that regard was when I was asked to review the last novel by Umberto Eco, Foucault's Pendulum. And Umberto Eco has been fantastically supportive of me and has signed all the relevant petitions and made a considerable amount of noise in Italy and been one of the writers who has been very vocal in my support over these years. And the problem was that I didn't like the novel. So I mean, I suppose there was 5 seconds when I thought, would it be wrong to give this novel a bad review because Eco has been so supportive? And then in the end, you have to tell yourself that you're not being paid to think like that. You're being, what the readers expect is that you will tell the truth about the book as you see it. So in the end, I had to trash this novel, which was, I think may have, I can understand that it might have upset Umberto Eco, but there was nothing else one can do if one doesn't like a book.
Well, were you reluctant to take on the assignment in the first place, knowing that,
no, I mean,
that this was a possibility?
You see, because I'd liked The Name of the Rose, and so I mean, I obviously hadn't read the book at the time that I was asked to do it. I thought I would like it, and it turned out that I didn't.
Have you heard from him since?
No, I haven't heard from him since, except indirectly. I think he is probably a little bit miffed.
What are you working on now?
Well, I'm writing a novel, and in fact, we just announced last week that I've just signed a contract for it with Random House in America, Pantheon. So it's do with it. And so now I'm writing it, and I'm afraid the thing that I'm most secretive about in the world is work in progress. So it's very hard for me to tell you much about it.
I can understand that.
Except as I have told one or two journalists, it's got a certain amount of sex and violence in it.
Okay.
I think that's about as much as I'm going to reveal right now. More sex than violence? Yeah.
Okay. How has your health been?
My health's been fine, actually, with the exception of the fact that, in a rather strange way, I've contracted asthma, which I've never had in my life, and now I do. I don't have it very badly, but that's been about the only problem I've had, fortunately, with the exception of having to have two wisdom teeth removed in the middle of all this, which required an absurd cloak and dagger operation.
Yes, I remember you telling me that in the last interview we did, and I've been thinking about that a lot since I'm preparing to have my mine removed, so I keep thinking, well, it'll be easier for me.
Yes, it probably will be easier for you.
I can just walk into the dentist.
Yes, exactly, whereas I had to go in this very curious backdoor method, and people in the hospital thought that some member of the royal family had probably turned up to have an abortion. It was just me and my wisdom teeth, I'm afraid.
So how did you get the asthma? Do you have any idea?
I don't know. I just suddenly contracted it. Apparently there is such a thing as late-onset asthma, and it's what I've got.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose there are theories that it's stress-related, so if that's so, then maybe there is an effect of all this. But apparently it can be brought on by all sorts of things.
I know you had started smoking again in hiding. Did you give it up after you got the asthma?
No, I stopped before I got the asthma. It didn't stop me getting the asthma, though.
Okay.
I did smoke again for about 9 months, but I must say I'm very pleased to reveal that I have returned to being good about that.
Good. This may seem like an odd question, but I know you're able to talk with friends on the telephone.
Mm.
I know if I were in your position, I'd probably always feel like I had nothing to talk about because there would be no day's events that I could actually tell anyone.
Yeah.
So do you feel like you run out of things to say, aside from talking about things that you've read?
Well, no, I haven't yet, because there's always them to talk about.
Right.
People are always quite happy to talk about themselves.
True.
So I catch up. In fact, I'm probably the kind of gossip centre of London. I probably have more dirt on more people than most of my friends do.
So you can write a Romana Clef novel soon.
One of these days,
right?
One of these days, well over Harold Brockier.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Salman Rushdie. His collection of essays, Imaginary Homelands, has been published in paperback by Granta. Satanic Verses is in paperback now, too. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. One of the most popular characters on the TV series Northern Exposure is Holling Vincour, the owner of the town's tavern. Holling is played by John Cullum, who had a long career in Broadway musicals before relocating to television. Coming up, John Cullum talks and sings. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Richard Price's new novel, Clockers, about a crack dealer. This marks his return to the novel after writing such screenplays as The Color of Money and Sea of Love. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Witnesses say gunfire by troops in Bangkok, Thailand, has scattered thousands of anti-government protesters, driving them from an intersection they had occupied overnight. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports that the latest incident follows 2 days of demonstrations by opponents of Thailand's military government.
Protesters were very angry this evening. Part of the reason could have been that several hundred protesters were arrested this afternoon, as well as the opposition leader, Chamlong Srimwong. The government is clearly trying to break up the protests and make everyone go home. The protesters were torching cars and motorcycles and traffic police little stall. The military answered back by firing at the demonstrators, and dozens of people were hit. Four were killed. Some doctors who are working nearby said that they treated more than 100 people, and of those, about 80 had gunshot wounds. The other 20 had been cracked over the head with batons.
NPR's Mary Kay Magstead in Bangkok. A government panel has approved continued use of Halcyon, the controversial sleeping drug. Medical experts today told the Food and Drug Administration advisory panel that Halcyon is safe and effective, but experts say the label should be changed to warn about psychiatric side effects. Halcyon is banned in Britain, and a U.S. consumer group asked the FDA to take it off the U.S. market. The group says Halcyon can cause hostility, depression, and death. In Oxford, England, a jury in a coroner's inquest says American pilots unlawfully killed 9 British soldiers during the Persian Gulf War. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
After 2 weeks of emotional testimony, the inquest jury deliberated only a short time before reaching their decision. The verdict of unlawful killing meant the jury had decided that the 2 pilots of the American A-10 planes had acted recklessly. It also showed the jurors sympathized with the parents of the dead soldiers. Throughout the trial, the lawyers representing the parents had requested that the American pilots be called as witnesses to clear up the many discrepancies between the British Ministry of Defense version of what happened and the Pentagon's version. The verdict will embarrass the defense officials in both countries. Outside the courthouse, amid popping champagne corks, Mark Stevens, a lawyer for the parents, said he wanted the court papers to be handed to the Director of Public Prosecutions, with a view that criminal proceedings against the pilots be instituted. However, one of the parents, Anne Leach, said she didn't want to see the American pilots prosecuted. She still just wants to know why they did it. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
Reports say band leader Lawrence Welk has died at age 89. On Wall Street, stocks moved up today. This is NPR News. There is a new amendment to the Constitution. It's the 27th, and it says any pay raise Congress votes itself cannot take effect until after the following election. The amendment took 202 years to be ratified, with approval by 3/4 of the states. The amendment was added to the Constitution as of today because this is the day it was certified by the National Archivist, Don Wilson. Critics had questioned whether the proposed amendment was still valid after so many years, but Wilson ruled there was no time limit. The Russian government has decreed a 6-fold increase in oil and natural gas prices. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
The new higher price ceilings for oil and natural gas were contained in a decree signed today by Russian President Boris Yeltsin, according to the Russian news agency. The move could raise the price of gasoline from 4.5 rubles to nearly 30 rubles, according to estimates here. The ruble is worth about a penny, but average salaries in Russia are estimated at under 2,000 rubles per month. The Russian government chose not to decontrol oil and gas prices last January because officials feared it would be too great an economic shock. Now that the winter is over and farmers have completed spring planting in many areas, officials have decided this is the time to begin the decontrol of oil prices. Today's move will not affect the price that Russia charges for the oil it exports, which is already in line with world prices. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
As television's Murphy Brown, actress Candace Bergen gives birth tonight. As herself, Bergen received an honorary college degree today from the school where she flunked out in 1965. The University of Pennsylvania has awarded the 46-year-old actress a Doctor of Laws degree. Bergen had left Penn after 2 years to pursue modeling in New York. In an interview, Bergen said Penn officials asked her to move on after sophomore year, and she respected them for it. But she said in later years they kept asking her for donations, and she did not give. Bergen says she knows the honorary degree has very little to do with reality. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Perhaps the most offbeat town on television is Sicily, Alaska, where just about every resident is an eccentric. Sicily is the setting of the series Northern Exposure. Tonight is the season finale, a special episode that will trace this fictional town's history. Northern Exposure is actually filmed in Roslyn, Washington, just outside of Seattle. So earlier this month, when I was in Seattle for a public radio conference, I interviewed one of the most popular members of the cast, John Cullum. Cullum comes to television from a long career on Broadway in such musicals as Men of La Mancha, Camelot, and 1776. He originated the leading roles in On a Clear Day and Shenandoah. In Northern Exposure, Cullum plays Hollingvin Kaur, a 63-year-old man whose lover is an 18-year-old beauty queen. Holling is the owner of the town's tavern. We recorded our interview at a popular Seattle tavern, the J&M Cafe, in front of an audience of public radio producers, program directors, and managers.
Thank you, Tara.
So, John, how was the character described to you when you first found out about Holling?
It was described to me as Gary Cooper meets Madonna. I said, I can live with that.
No, but here's the thing, you know, let's get right to it. In a relationship where there's an older person with an 18-year-old,
right.
The terms that our society often uses is cradle snatcher, right? It's such a loving relationship. People really dig the relationship. So how is it talked over to make it just a kind of relationship everybody would relate to and feel really warmly about?
You mean how did we devise a method of making it work or palatable even? We didn't. It's obvious that it's an outrageous relationship in the sense of the ages of the two people being different. But I never thought about that. I just thought, this is great for the old guy, you know. And if it's okay with her, it's okay with me. When we do the sex scenes, I've done sex scenes that I never thought I would ever do, and I wouldn't have done 10 years ago, but the first time I did any of those scenes was a circumcision scene.
Oh, yeah.
And it started off with me post-sex, it said in the script. She asks me a question about my virility, and I get a little upset. And then she looks down and says, you know, and I say, what's wrong? And she says, it's got a turtleneck. And I thought when I read this scene, I said, I could raise hell and say something about ridiculous, you know, I will only do this scene if it's necessary to the script and all that sort of stuff. But I thought, they'll never do this. It'll get cut.
No pun intended, right?
It got cut. It got cut. And then I saw it on television, and there I was, and there she was looking down. And, of course, all you could see was her looking down, and she said, looks like it's got a turtleneck, and I just about fell through the floor. I thought it was. But that was my first experience. After that, everything was kind of easy going.
So are there no, like, standards and practices, people reading the scripts every week and saying, you can't say that, you can't do that on TV?
I say it sometimes. They have in a TV script, they have a tendency to write what I call opposing ideas. I mean, like the old man with a young girl. And if I'm strong and virile, they will want me to cry. They've had those kind of contrary scenes. So, and which I think that's fine. That's fast, quick. It gets the point across, and it's very good writing. But sometimes they have a tendency to write things that put me off a little bit.
Like and what?
Well, they had one scene where they wanted me to say that I love who I don't care anything about you, your mind. I only love you for your body. And I was prepared to make an issue of it, and I thought, no, I won't make an issue of it. I'll go, because they've been right about everything so far, and the scenes that were embarrassing to me and difficult to play didn't turn out to be embarrassing and really weren't difficult to play. And strangely enough, they were humorous and not in bad taste. But this scene got me, it riled me, because I didn't like the concept of the idea. And I thought, well, I will play this scene and I'll take the easy way out. I will paraphrase it. If I don't like it, I'll paraphrase it. And if they make an issue of it, I won't say it. I'll simply say, I won't do it. And what happened was, I got into the scene, and as I was playing it, it came out exactly as it was written, and instead of being something that was putting Shelley down, it turned out as a kind of a crude way of saying how much I really loved you, because she was very concerned about me not caring for her physically. So it turned out to be a loving thing, and as long as it worked on that level, I got through that scene and it was okay.
My guest is John Cullum, who plays Holling Vancour on Northern Exposure. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to an interview I recorded in Seattle with John Cullum of Northern Exposure.
I want to hear something about your Broadway career. Now, you're a baritone, right?
Baritone.
So I think the only singing that you did before you got to Broadway was in the church choir.
That's right.
Yeah? So did you have the right kind of voice for projecting on a Broadway stage when you got to Broadway after singing
No.
in the church choir?
No, not really. But when I got to Broadway, I got into a production of Finian's Rainbow, playing Woody. It was a fluke, and an agent saw me, and he kept putting me up for musicals. And I was working doing Shakespeare in the Park for Joe Papp, and I was very comfortable in tights. Much more comfortable in tights than in singing, I can tell you that. But the audition was a disaster, but they asked me back, and I couldn't figure out why. But they asked me back a second time, and then they asked me, can you do something from Shakespeare? I said, I beg your pardon? I said, can you do something from Shakespeare? I said, I can do practically anything from Shakespeare, which was ridiculous. I had just done a couple of shows in Shakespeare, but I was also inebriated at the time. I hate to say this over public, anywhere, but the truth is, I was so nervous about singing that I finally started bolstering my confidence with liquor. And I was pretty blotched out when I sang the first time. And when I came back the second time, I was sober, but very, very nervous. Anyway, they asked me to do Shakespeare. I read some Shakespeare for them, and they needed a standby for Richard Burton. And I got hired as the last person in the chorus to stand by for Richard Burton and for Roddy McDowell, and that's how I got into musical comedy.
Well, you were Richard Burton's standby in Camelot, right?
That's right.
So when you were understudying Richard Burton, yeah. Did you pick up all of his mannerisms?
Oh, my God, yes. It took me 6 years to get over. over risk. I can still get into trouble if I'm not careful. A long was made a distant moon. Oh, yes, it was awful, but every review that I ever did, I was in his Hamlet, too. I played Laertes in that. And then I did my own Hamlet afterwards in Milwaukee. And every reviewer was very impressed with my Burton-esque performance. To be or not to be. I found that I even twisted a pinky ring. And when I got nervous on stage, somebody said, "What are you doing? What does this mean?" And I said, "What does what mean?" Richard used to twist a pinky ring. And I even picked up physical mannerisms from him.
I want to read something that you once said. You once said, after being brought up on the King James version of the Bible, Shakespeare's a snap. So did you like have to recite a lot from the Bible when you were?
What are you going to make me say?
I was hoping you'd recite from
the 23rd Psalm. I don't. I'm not going to try to recite anything from the Bible. But
did you have to do that when you were growing up?
Yeah, sword drills, and you know anybody in the Southern Baptist Church. My brother's a Baptist minister. My sister's married to a Baptist minister, and I'm the black sheep. But it was translated in 1603, which means it was right in the middle of Shakespeare's time. So if you can read Shakespeare, if you can read the King James Version, which most of us can, that's why Americans really, if they get a good production of Shakespeare, can understand it quite readily, most of them, who read the Bible at all.
Now, you grew up in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Right.
You went into the Army in Korea for
that's
a couple
right.
of years, got out of the Army, and decided to get a master's degree in finance, worked in your father's real estate office. And
this
then,
is your life.
Yeah, right. and then you split for Broadway. You decided to just like leave and go to New York.
Yeah. I was leading three different lives in Knoxville, Tennessee. I was going to the university. I was working in my dad's office. And I was the kind of a fair-haired guy. I'd done a lot of theater. And I was the tennis champion and the president of the fraternity and all of this kind of stuff. And I was also the conductor of the Dixie Lee Junction Baptist Choir, which was a little choir way out. And I was picked up for drunken driving. It sounds like I was a real drunkard. Well, the truth is I drank a lot, and I don't drink anymore, but I was picked up for drunken driving, and it hit the papers. And if it hadn't been for that, I don't think I'd have had the courage to make the decision. I was 26. I had a nice business to take over, my dad's business. Obviously, I was unhappy. And I used that opportunity to break and go to New York.
So will we get to hear you sing on Northern Exposure, Sing More?
You mean, I did sing.
You sang Ave Maria.
Yeah.
Have they thought of trying to work in more of your singing into the show?
I don't know. It seemed like pulling hen's teeth then. You know, then I don't know whether I've ever told this story to anybody. It's a little embarrassing. But in the second or third episode, there was a section where Maurice took over the radio station, and he's playing Broadway show tunes that the astronauts went up into outer space with. Then he names one Glenn liked to go up by Yule by the King and I, and another one, Kiss Me Kate, and this is the one he says that I went up in, and it was On a Clear Day You Can See Forever. And I looked at that thing, and I thought, these guys don't realize that if they play the Broadway album, that's going to be me singing that song.
Wow.
And they didn't know that.
They really didn't know that?
No, they didn't know that.
Did you tell them?
I did, and they cut it. Yeah. I don't know whether they really realized it. Finally, they got around to asking me to do Ave Maria. And I was very nervous about that because they wanted me to do a cappella. And Ave Maria is an art song. It's not that easy to sing.
You know what I'd really love to do, and you could just tell me no. I'd love to ask you to sing a chorus of On a Clear Day.
Only for you, Terry. Can I do the introduction?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I don't even know whether I can know the words. Anyway, this is the scene where he's talking to Daisy Campbell, who has extrasensory perception. And he says, could anyone among us have an inkling or a clue what magic feats of wizardry and voodoo you can do? And who would ever guess what powers you possess? And who would have the sense to change his views and start to mind his ESPs and Qs? And who would ever dream of hearing phones before they ring, or ordering the earth to send you up a little spring, or finding you've been crowned the queen of lost and found? And who would not be stunned to see you prove there's more to us than surgeons can remove? So much more than we ever knew. So much more were we born to do. Should you draw back the curtain, this I am certain, you'll be impressed with you. On a clear day, rise and look around you, and you'll see who. On a clear day, how it will astound you that the glow of your being outshines every star. You'll feel part of every mountain, sea, and shore. You can hear from far and near a world you've never heard before. And on a clear day, I started in the wrong key. You realize that?
Actor John Cullum, he plays Holling Vincourt on Northern Exposure. The season finale is tonight. Our interview with John Cullum was produced by Catherine Ball. Thanks also to Art Ellis and Greg Coe. The engineers were Lowell Kizo and Gene Gatlin of public station KPLU in Seattle. A special thanks to Woody Crocker, the set designer for Northern Exposure. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll have news today of the protests and the suppression of protests in Bangkok, Thailand. Also, a talk with Washington Post correspondent Lena Sun in Beijing about how Chinese security police burst into her office yesterday and demanded that she open the newspaper's safe for them, the bureau's safe, on what happened to her and why she thinks it might have happened. We'll also have a special report from Michelle Trudeau about facilitated communication. That is a very controversial method of teaching autistic children. Michelle reports on how it works.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Richard Price first became known for his novel The Wanderers, about street gangs in the Bronx, where he grew up. People assumed he was a tough guy, which he wasn't. Several novels and screenplays later, he's returned to the territory of street gangs. Maureen Corrigan has a review of Clockers.
First things first, the big controversy being stirred up by Clockers is whether or not Richard Price should have written it. After all, Price is from a lower middle class Jewish background, and Clockers takes place inside the world of black crack dealers. Can white artists really peer into the souls of characters from other races? This has been a hot critical question ever since William Styron wrote The Confessions of Nat Turner. I think the answer is, it depends. When Elvis Presley sang In the Ghetto, something didn't feel quite right. But last year, fans of the Native American autobiography, The Education of Little Tree, were stunned when they found out it was really written by some white guy who was a former speechwriter for George Wallace. Despite the fact that it's a fake, Little Tree still feels true to a lot of readers. if Price had written Clockers under the pseudonym Buddha Hat, which is the street name of one of his characters, I bet we reviewers would be hailing the birth of an authentic voice from the inner city. Of course, most reviewers are white too, so we may be easily fooled. But Price has always been known for his dead-on dialogue, his insider observations. Clockers is a tale of Darwinian-style crack capitalism that's so raw, the question is not whether Price should have written it, but who out there is going to want to read it. Clockers unfolds in a fictitious New Jersey city. The main character, Strike, supervises a crew of cocaine dealers, clockers, who work out of a housing project. Even though he makes big bucks preying on junkies and seduces an 11-year-old boy into joining his crew, Strike doesn't think of himself as a criminal. Clocking, he says, is just what he does, his best shot at having a life, like going into the army or working for UPS. Strike is scum, but he's not the animal that his boss, Rodney, is. So when Rodney orders Strike to kill a rival drug dealer named Daryl, Strike's ulcers act up. While Strike's busy chug-a-lugging Yoo-Hoo like it was Mylanta, Daryl is murdered, and Strike's nice, hard-working brother Victor confesses to the hit. A detective on the case, Rocco Klein, doesn't buy Victor's story. Rocco is nearing retirement and feeling up to his eyeballs in the nothingness of people's lives. But Rocco's zest for his job returns when he makes it his mission to nail Strike for the murder. Price borrows a narrative trick here from 19th century novelists like Elizabeth Gaskell and Charles Dickens, who also wrote about social problems. They always dangled a romance subplot like a carrot to entice their readers through their grim factory tales. I think Price uses his murder mystery subplot for similar reasons. But Price so quickly converted me to the brutal logic of the streets that I stopped caring about who killed Daryl. He was just another body. What kept me reading Clockers was its God's-eye view of hell, the inner city, what some cynics have called the self-cleaning oven. Will other readers want to keep images of slum motels, jail cells, and knifings before their eyes for 600 pages, especially after L.A.? I don't know. The great aesthetic achievement of Clockers may also be its biggest sales liability.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Richard Price's novel Clockers. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. Support for today's program also came from the Guinness Import Company of Stamford, Connecticut. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we mark the birthday of Malcolm X with writer Claiborne Carson, author of Malcolm X, The FBI File. Also, we talk with Klaus Oldenburg about turning everyday objects into colossal public monuments. He created a giant clothespin for Philadelphia, a rubber stamp for Cleveland, a fruit bowl for Miami. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.